this is JJ Virgin. Welcome and thanks so much for joining me. This is Ask the Health Expert. Here I put the power of health in your hands and give you access to the top people in health and wellness. In each episode, I share safe ways to get healthy, lose weight, heal your gut, detox, and lots more. So if you want to get healthy and get off the dieting for life merry-go-round, I'll give you strategies that will help you look and feel better fast. All right, so today on Ask the Health Expert, I've got Dr. Stephen Gundry. So it's going to be Ask the Cardiothoracic Surgeon and actually Ask the Nutrition Expert. And well, here's what's super fun. I have known Dr. Stephen Gundry for, gosh, I think now 20 plus years because we both were in Palm Springs together. So I used to go to his office way, way, way back when. It's just been fun to watch everything he's been up to over the past two decades. So I think I got him right when he was probably starting the nutrition part. He just stopped doing surgery a couple years ago. But he has the International Heart and Lung Institute and the Centers for Restorative Medicine, both in Palm Springs and Santa Barbara. Beautiful places to live. He's got the Dr. Gundry podcast and four New York Times bestselling books, including The Plant Paradox. And we are going to talk today about his latest book, Unlocking the Keto Code, which isn't really about keto. So if you're going, I don't care about keto. No, this is like what makes keto work and how you can take that information and basically, you know, live longer, better. It's really about the longevity of it. And it's super cool, actionable information as always, because that's what he's all about in providing. So I will be right back with Dr. Stephen Gundry. Stay with me. All right, so on this episode of Ask the Health Expert, I'm going to ask my favorite cardiothoracic surgeon and, you know, I would say you're a definite nutrition geek, advocate and expert and pioneer. I've got Dr. Stephen Gundry with me yet again, a crowd pleaser. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, JJ. I'm glad to know that Tampa is still alive and you're still alive, so that's good.
I am. So I am excited about this because we're going to bust some myths. We're going to share some new concepts, get in a little bit on, we never really talked about your book on Unlocking the Keto Code. So I know you've got some stuff in there too. So we have a lot to talk about here today.
Okay.
For those of you who don't know Dr. Gundry, I would just love you to give me a brief, like, how the heck did you go from, you know, cardiothoracic surgeon into getting so dialed into nutrition and lifestyle?
Yeah, real briefly, I was professor and chairman of cardiothoracic surgery at Loma Linda University here in Southern California, and pioneered with my partner, Leonard Bailey, infant heart transplant, and invented a bunch of devices to keep the heart alive during heart surgery and transplant, and was one of the fathers of computer-assisted heart surgery, blah, blah, blah. And I was also very famous for operating on people who nobody else wanted to operate on, and there were a few of us idiots around the country. And I was introduced to a gentleman from Miami, Florida, who I call Big Ed in all the books, many years ago now. He was 48 years old and inoperable coronary artery disease. All his blood vessels were so clogged up that you couldn't put stents in them. You couldn't do bypasses because there wasn't any place to land a bypass. And he was a big, fat guy, Big Ed. He weighed 305 pounds, and he would go around the country carrying his angiogram, the movie of his heart, looking for somebody to operate on him. And he had spent about 6 months going around the country, and everyone who saw him turned him down. And he eventually wound up in my office, and I looked at his angiogram from 6 months earlier, and I said, you know, I got to agree with everybody else. There's nothing I can do for you. I'm sorry. And he said, well, yeah, but. I've been on a diet for 6 months and I've lost 45 pounds. Now, he was 265 when I met him. And he says, and I've gone to a health food store and I've been taking a bunch of supplements. And he actually brought in this huge shopping bag. And he said, you know, maybe I did something in here. And, you know, I'm scratching my professor beard and going, well, you know, good for you for losing weight, but that's not going to do anything in here. And I know what you did with all those supplements. You made expensive urine, which is what I firmly believed back then. And he said, well, look, I've come all this way. Why don't we get another angiogram? And so I agreed. And this guy, in 6 months' time, had cleaned out 50% of the blockages in his coronary arteries. 50%. I
mean, holy smokes.
Yeah. And I have never, I have never seen anything like that. In fact, you know, I've been on the program committee for the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology multiple times through the years. And astounding results of a statin trial, for instance, would show a 0.01% reduction in plaque over 5 years. And that was astounding. And, you know, we would trumpet it to the media and wow. And here's Big Ed cleaning out, you know, 50% reduction in 6 months. And I'm going, what the heck? You know, what have you been eating? And this guy starts telling me what he's been eating. And back in the dark ages at Yale as an undergraduate, we could design our own major. So I designed a major that you could take a great ape and manipulate its food supply, manipulate its environment, and prove you'd arrive at a human being. And I defended my thesis, got an honors, and gave it to my parents and went off to be a famous heart surgeon. So when Big Ed's telling me about his diet, I go, wait a minute, this was my thesis. And I said, let me look at those supplements. And again, famous for protecting the heart during transplant and operations. And I had designed a glop that you put down the veins and arteries of the heart before you cut it out that protected it. And Big Ed is swallowing a bunch of the things that I put in this glop, and it never occurred to me to swallow it. So I was a big fat guy, even though I was running 30 miles a week, going to the gym 1 hour a day and eating what I thought was a very healthy, low-fat diet. Mm-hmm. I'm a heart surgeon. And so I put myself on my thesis and started swallowing a bunch of Big Ed supplements. And, you know, I lost 50 pounds my first year and 20 subsequently, and I've kind of kept it off for 25 years now. But what I did was I took the patients that I operated on and I said, here, you know, I want you to start eating this way and go to Costco, go to Trader Joe's. There wasn't an Amazon back then. And buy some of these supplements. They're cheap. And I want to keep you away from me in the future. And they had some remarkable changes. Their diabetes went away. Their high blood pressure went away. Their arthritis went away. So after about a year of this at Loma Linda, I had an epiphany that I was actually doing this all wrong. Instead of operating on people and then teaching them how to eat to avoid me in the future, I decided I should teach them how to eat so they could avoid me right now. Now, as a heart surgeon, that's a very bad career move.
Bad business decision there.
Very bad, as
but
my
wife. But it seems to have worked out.
It did work out after many, many years of not working out. My wife likes to remind me many times. And so I resigned my position and set up a clinic, as you know, in Palm Springs, California.
Yeah, I know.
California.
We were neighbors.
And we were neighbors.
Yeah.
I remember you used to come into my office and we'd chat. And
there you go. The way back when.
Yeah. So, and I guess the rest is history. We found that, in fact, there were certain foods that were mischievous, that there were certain foods that were pretty good for you, and that there were, quite frankly, a number of supplements that had some pretty remarkable powers that I actually wrote about, published papers about. And then the plant paradox happened about 5.5 years ago now that kind of upended, I guess, conventional thinking about how plants don't necessarily want us to eat them. And there you go.
And it's important that, you know, like you and I both agree on this concept that I think really disrupts nutrition, that foods that are considered healthy could actually be hurting you. And getting that word out, which is almost like saying, hey, the earth is flat, you know, hey, so, but, you know, we really do, especially in this day that we're really moving into bioindividuality and personalized nutrition. It's like an important message out there. Now, We're going to talk longevity because you are my favorite person to yak about longevity with all of your info on the blue zones, et cetera. But I want to first dig into your latest book. I know you got more stuff you're working on. I want to get into that too. But we never got a chance to talk about unlocking the keto code. And I loved the provocative statement of they're doing keto all wrong. And so I think it's important to dig into this because I still remember the keto from the days that keto was pork rinds and Diet Coke. You know, remember those days?
Oh, yeah.
And then I used it some with my son with his brain injury, of course, right, because it was super important. But, you know, for someone now, because whenever these things, you look at a diet and the diet gets popular and then the diet becomes a junk food diet. It happens every single time, like the gluten-free diet and all the garbage that's now gluten-free. So,
yeah,
you know, what's your take on the keto diet? How has it been misused? How do we upgrade it and how do we use it?
Well, we, as you know, with your son's brain injury, ketones and a ketogenic diet was first used for children with seizure disorders before there were any anti-seizure medications. And it was designed at the Mayo Clinic. And the name ketogenic diet actually came from the Mayo Clinic in 1930. So it's known.
It's not a fad. There we go.
It's not a fad.
I always love when people say that.
It worked remarkably well. And when drugs came out, it really kind of fell by the wayside, at least for kids. But it had a resurgence in the 1990s in a different form. As anybody who takes care of people on anti-seizure medications and kids on anti-seizure medications, these medications, for lack of a better word, depress brain function. That's kind of what they're supposed to do. And these kids, although their seizures were controlled, they weren't exactly the brightest light bulbs in school. And so people got the idea that, and the other thing that's a problem with a high fat diet, the original ketogenic diet was 80% fat, 10% protein, and 10% carbohydrate. And getting a kid to eat a low carbohydrate diet is nearly impossible. And most of us working in nutrition realize that getting an adult to eat a low carbohydrate diet for any length of time is virtually impossible. So they got the idea that if you used MCT oil, medium chain triglycerides, as a fat, that interestingly enough, you could give kids a lot less MCT oil as a percentage of the fat they ate, give them more carbohydrates and give them more proteins, and they'd still have seizure control. And so they became fascinated, as I did when I wrote The Plant Paradox, and I have a ketogenic version of all my books. I used MCT oil for that purpose. And MCTs are fascinating in that, unlike any other fat that we eat, MCT oil is immediately absorbed through the wall of our gut. All other fats have to be packaged, and I won't go into that. But they go direct to your liver, do not pass go, and they are converted into ketones. Now, ketones are not a miraculous fuel, and that's one of the points of the book. When I wanted to try and explain how ketones work, of course, most people think, oh, it's a clean burning fuel, your body prefers burning ketones over carbohydrates. It's, you know, it's rocket fuel for your brain. Well, unfortunately, it's not. Research at the NIH, where I was an associate, research at Harvard, has shown that even at full ketosis in human beings, 70% of your body's energy needs cannot be met by ketones. Only about 30% can be met by full ketosis. And even the brain, which certainly can do well on ketones, your brain still needs 30 to 40% of its fuel as glucose, even running, you know, at a full ketogenic diet. So with that in mind, I said, gee, there's something wrong with this super fuel concept. So if ketones are not this phenomenal super fuel, what the heck are they doing? Why is it beneficial to the brain? Why is it beneficial to at least sometime during the day be making ketone? And a rather obscure paper It's short. I recommend anybody read it. It's a fun little read written by a PhD by the name of Martin Brand in the year 2000. The name of the paper is Uncoupling to Survive. Easy to remember. Now, uncoupling has nothing to do with Gwyneth Paltrow.
That's cute.
So what the heck is uncoupling? Normally, making energy, making ATP by mitochondria is incredibly hard work. It's incredibly damaging to mitochondria. And all of us know about reactive oxygen species, et cetera, et cetera. And mitochondria get damaged making ATP. And the object of the game is to energize electrons in the mitochondria and pull protons into the mitochondria and couple a proton with oxygen and make ATP. And I describe this in the book as the Mito Club, the hottest, hippest club in town. And it's difficult to make ATP. So interestingly enough, mitochondria, to protect themselves, have a built-in pressure release valve, very much like a pressure cooker has a pop-off valve. And these are little trap doors, escape hatches, and there's five of them in each mitochondria. They're controlled by what are called uncoupling proteins. And uncoupling refers to normally a proton should couple with an oxygen and in that process make ATP. If you uncouple, you don't connect a proton with oxygen, then the proton actually escapes without making energy. And it turns out that that's actually pretty doggone good for you, depending on how much of that is allowed to happen. What's really interesting is you and I sitting here, 30% of all the calories we eat never are used to make ATP. They are uncoupled in our mitochondria and escape. Now you go, well, that's kind of a dumb design. Why would anybody do that? We are a warm-blooded animal, and it turns out those molecules escaping, those protons, generate heat. And so just sitting around, we need to generate heat.
Escape if you're in a colder, like if you're doing a cold plunge, you're like,
boom.
Okay. Just because I cold plunge every morning now, Stephen.
It turns out that cold plunges work by actually stimulating your mitochondria to uncouple to produce more heat. And quite frankly, up to a limit, maybe we can talk about that, the more your mitochondria are told to uncouple by, for instance, a cold plunge or a sauna, reverse engineering, same thing happens, or by certain foods or certain dietary practices, like going into ketosis, work by uncoupling mitochondria. So it turns out the ketones are actually a signaling molecule that tell mitochondria that there's no food, times are rough, we don't know when the next meal is coming, and protect yourselves at all costs, because you little mitochondria, if you die, we're done. Who cares about the muscles? Who cares about your skin? Who cares about your hair? If you guys die, that's it. And so the uncoupling to survive theory that Dr. Brand proposed has actually been confirmed by some fascinating study. You look at 105-year-old people, speaking of longevity around the world, they have the most uncoupled mitochondria.
Well, so here's the question, because obviously if all of your mitochondria were uncoupled, you wouldn't be making any energy, and that would be a problem too.
Correct.
So there must be the beautiful sweet spot, right?
Yeah, there's two sweet spots. So when mitochondria get the message to uncouple, and they not only protect themselves, but they're actually signaled to make more of themselves to share the workload.
Oh, that's a very good thing.
It's a very good thing. And I like to use the example of a dog sled. If I had one dog on my dog sled, yeah, it could pull the dog sled. Wouldn't go very fast, wouldn't go very far because the dog would get tired. But if I hooked another five dogs up to the dog sled and had a 16 dog sled, each individual dog would do a sixth of the work. It would go a lot faster and a lot farther. The only downside would be I'd have to feed six dogs instead of one dog. That actually explains why a ketogenic diet and uncoupling mitochondria makes you lose weight.
Yeah, I was going to say that's actually a good thing if you need more calories to maintain your body. That's awesome. Who doesn't want to have more, you know, more calories? That is super interesting. Wow.
I'll just give you one more fun example. Most of us have heard of the theory of aging that goes into the cost of living hypothesis. And that is, if you're running a very high metabolic rate, in general, you don't live very long. And if you run a low metabolic rate, in general, you live a lot longer. And most of the time, this appears to be correct. Little tiny animals have a very rapid metabolic rate. They don't live very long. Big animals like elephants, us, blue whales, have a relatively lower metabolic rate, and they live a lot longer. Makes sense. The exception to that is birds. Birds are actually some of the longest living creatures, and yet they're quite small. A parrot can live 80 to 100 years. A hummingbird, which has one of the highest metabolic rates ever measured, a hummingbird's heart rate is 1,100 beats per minute. And yet a hummingbird in captivity can live 12 years, about the same as our dogs. And so when people said, well, what the heck? How's this happening? It turns out that hummingbirds have, and birds in general, have very uncoupled mitochondria. And that actually explains why they live so long, because their mitochondria don't undergo the damage that that high metabolic rate would appear to do.
Okay, so here's the important question then, because, you know, when I think back to why people believe ketogenic diets work, it's because it forces your body to use ketones and fat for fuel, and the only glucose you're going to keep it for your brain, all of that stuff. And you're more satiated. So the reality is it's this mitochondrial uncoupling. So the question is, does it require you to be in ketosis or even mild ketosis to do mitochondrial uncoupling? Or are there other things that you can do that also have this effect?
So
like cold plunging.
Yeah, so that's unlocking the keto code. Once you know the code that ketones are telling your mitochondria to uncouple, then you start saying, well, are there other ways to achieve the same thing? And that's the exciting thing in the book, that in fact, you don't need to eat a high-fat diet to uncouple mitochondria. Time-restricted eating is a really great way to uncouple mitochondria. But
and how much time-restricted, when you say time-restricted, since that's all over the board?
So probably the sweet spot is a 6-hour eating window. What does that look like? You have break fast at noon and you finish your dinner at 6. Variations on the theme. As you know, for the last 23 years now.
Your winter routine.
I've been doing my winter routine of an OMAD diet, one meal a day, for 6 months. And I eat all my calories in a 2-hour window. Work out of the NIH suggests that there's probably no additional benefit of that compressed an eating window over a 6-hour eating window. There's a beautiful study that I talk about in the book with Italian athletes, which really confirms, I think, the benefit of how this system works. They took Italian athletes, bicyclists, and they put them on a training table. Everybody had to eat the same thing for 3 months. They divided them into two groups. One group ate it in a 12-hour eating window. They had breakfast at 8 o'clock in the morning. They had lunch at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. They had to finish dinner by 8 o'clock, 12-hour eating window. The other group had breakfast at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. They had lunch at 4 o'clock, and they had to finish dinner at 8 o'clock, 7-hour eating window. Followed them for 3 months. Only the group, even though they ate the exact same calories, their exact same food, only the group at a 7-hour eating window lost weight. They had the same exercise performance. But the best part, the longevity part, is the group with the short window had dramatically lowered insulin-like growth factor ones, IGF-1, which so far is our best marker for knowing whether mTOR is activated or not.
So do you think, because honestly, I'm still hearing out there that the reason intermittent fasting works, you know what I'm going to say, is because you're cutting calories. Why are these things getting ignored? And why are they not talking about the hormonal impact and what's going on with mTOR when you do this? So I'd love you to dive into that.
Yeah. And again, the Italian study has clearly shown, as have other studies, but this human study showed that it has nothing to do with calories. There's another human study that I talk about in the book, replacing some of the calories in an equal calorie diet with MCT oil instead of other fats. And the other fat just happened to be olive oil. And in that program, even though the calories were identical, the fat calories were identical, the group that had the MCT oil lost 5 kilograms more than the group that was using olive oil.
Over what period of time, and how much?
A 3-month calorie.
How much did they change of olive oil to MCT?
So I try to get people to get a minimum of 3 tablespoons of MCT oil a day into them. Now, women, as you may or may not know, are fairly sensitive to MCT oil initially. You get queasy stomach, you get diarrhea. I have to start my women patients slow. I've found in my practice that, interestingly enough, powdered MCT is much better tolerated than liquid MCT for females. And there's a lot of great powdered MCT coffee creamers. I happen to make one at Country MD, which I use every day. And I designed it particularly for my female patients. So you can get MCT. MCT is tasteless. You want to try to get C8 MCT. It combines easily with olive oil and salad dressings, and that's an easy way to get it into your system. Or you can just pour it on vegetables. You can't cook with it. Calorie in, calorie out.
It's still out there.
Don't get me started. Calorie in, calorie out does not even account for what the microbiome is going to eat of what you consume, nor does it compensate for the fact that we now know there are obesogenic bacteria, which are more than happy to convert lots of what you swallow into absorbable forms that you will absorb and get fat, whereas they're the opposite, what I call gut buddies, will take all those calories for themselves and make more little gut buddies and don't give you any. And so, calorie is not a calorie.
So there's that. I mean, just the basic macronutrients, knowing that protein is going to have a more thermic effect than fat or carbs.
True.
I mean, it's like you cannot ever look at like that whole model. It just still drives me nuts. But yes, then you bring in the hormones, then you bring in the gut microbiome, and it's just so much more than just calories. And then you just do these studies, and I feel like these studies just continue to get ignored. But you're getting it out there, and I super appreciate that. I have to go through one thing with you, Stephen, because you mentioned this before we started, and I go, there's one other area besides calories that lights me up, and I get asked all the time on social about this, and it's the other myth that just will not seem to die. It's the high cholesterol scary, scary myth. I look at total cholesterol, kind of looking at body weight, like you got to know what it's made up of. But then you get people who even with high, they come in with high LDL freaked out. Can you just, as a cardiothoracic surgeon who has dealt with this, unpack this and tell people what they really should be looking at and be concerned with?
One of the great fathers of heart surgery, Michael DeBakey from Houston, Texas, one of the true fathers, I got to know him in his later years, he said back in the 1950s and 60s that he really thought cholesterol had nothing to do with heart disease, with plaque, and that cholesterol was an innocent bystander that happened to get caught up in inflammation on the surface of blood vessels. And as I've talked about in my books, you could think of cholesterol almost as a patch or an ambulance. And I've joked that if I was an alien orbiting the Earth, wanting to report back to high command, what do I observe? One of the things that I could report back is that I'm pretty sure that ambulances cause car accidents, because every time I see a car accident, there's an ambulance. And of course, association does not mean causation. And just because we see cholesterol in a plaque doesn't mean that that cholesterol actually caused the plaque. It might be there for a completely different purpose. And I've certainly taken that to heart as a heart surgeon. Ha ha ha. The interesting thing is that I have a number of patients who come to me with very high cholesterols. And I'll give you an example from just this week. I have a lady in her late 60s, very healthy, but she runs a total cholesterol in the 400s. She has LDLs in the high 300s, and she has actually very good HDL, and she actually has very low triglycerides, and I won't go into triglycerides, but her physicians, well-meaning, have been trying to get her to take statins for her entire life. When she tries statins, she gets some of the typical statin complaints, and so she just won't do it. We do some really interesting, sophisticated blood tests looking at whether the inside of your blood vessels are sticky, whether they're attractive to cholesterol, and I've published several papers about this. And there are now more and more sophisticated looks at whether these particles of LDL actually have any interest in causing inflammation. And those of you who can ask for it, there's a fascinating new blood test called OX, O-X, capital P, capital L, which stands for phospholipids, dash ApoB, A-P-O, capital B. And this test actually discriminates very well whether or not your cholesterol has any interest in sticking to blood vessels, whether it's activated. And so this lady we've been following through the years, and she never has an activated OxBL ApoB, despite having a LDL cholesterol in the 300, despite having small, dense LDLs. And I've told her, hey, you know, have a nice day, you know, enjoy your cholesterol. I'm not going to do anything. Well, one of her well-meaning cardiologists couldn't take it any longer. And he, a week ago, got a CT coronary angiogram, which is actually a really good test looking for plaque. In fact, for seeing plaque, it's better than a coronary angiogram. And lo and behold, surprise, surprise, this lady who's 68 years old has zero coronary plaque, zero coronary calcification, which is a joke anyhow, but don't get me started. Perfect coronary arteries, exactly what my blood test would have predicted. Now, you'll never guess, armed with that information, what her cardiologist told her.
You need to take statins.
Yeah. I don't care what I just saw. I don't care that that blood test would have predicted what I just saw. I need to get your LDL down.
Now, is that just because he has to stay within the standard of care? Otherwise, he's going to get in trouble by the big scary hospital board. Like, what the heck is that?
Well, yeah, for instance, so, you know, when I operate on a patient, and I gave up heart surgery about 4 years ago.
Well, you fixed people so they didn't need to do it anymore.
When I, you know, before I could discharge somebody from the hospital, I would have to put them on a statin drug, show that I documented that I sent them home on a statin drug. Now, of course, the next thing I tell them is, now, don't you dare take that. But yeah, so a lot of this is, you got to do it to be in compliance.
What's a poor, like the thankfully people are listening to this and know better, but what do they do? Like, what's someone do who is getting this information? How do they find a person like you to come and see? I guess they can fly to Palm Springs or Santa Barbara, right? But, outside of that, what does someone do? Because it's so prevalent.
Yeah, well, it's, I just actually, we just soft launching my telemedicine, Gundry Health, so that you don't have to come and fly to see me. I've trained a bunch of doctors around the world, and we're going to do this.
Excellent. That is such great stuff. I am so thrilled to hear
Gundry
that.
So Gundry Health.
There you go. And we're going to link all this in the show notes, your website, books, all of this. I'd love to close with something. So what you don't know is when we talked last, we were talking about food and we started talking about olive oil and you just sent me all your awesome olive oil, holy smokes. And then I was heading off to Italy. And so I just decided, you know what? You told me that study was a liter of olive oil a week and I'm in, the
Italy.
Mother country. We were like just arugula and olive oil. Arugula, it was fantastic. Yeah. So I just would love to leave everyone with the olive oil, because you talked about MCT and olive oil, but we haven't gone into just why you want to make sure that you're incorporating olive oil into your diet. And then we'll link to that too, because you've got some fantastic olive oil.
So olive oil is mostly oleic acid, which is a monounsaturated fat, which isn't particularly interesting as a fat. It's not miraculous. But olive oil, if it's done right, is loaded with polyphenols, a number of polyphenols. And it turns out that it's the polyphenol content of olive oil that makes it so spectacular. And there are so two of the blue zones, both Crete and Sardinia, use a liter of olive oil per week. There's a very famous study out of Spain called the PREDIMED study, where people with known heart disease were forced to use a liter of olive oil per week. They were given a container. They had to come back to the clinic once a week and exchange it. And they were followed for 5 years. These were 65-year-old people, and they were compared to a low-fat Mediterranean diet. One of the things they found was a 30% reduction in new coronary artery disease in the olive oil group, but an increased amount of coronary artery disease in the low-fat group. But one of the most amazing parts of this study was cognition. The people in the olive oil group had improved memory at the end of 5 years. Now think about it, you take 65-year-old people, and you get to 70 and your memory is probably not going to be quite as good. These guys improved their memory over 5 years, whereas the low fat group, their memory decreased, as you would expect. And so it's not only just for your heart, and it's these polyphenols. And the punchline of all of this, and it's in the book, Unlocking the Keto Code, polyphenols are one of the best ways ever found to uncouple your mitochondria.
And boy, would I have loved to have been on that study that had to go out there and get a liter of real olive. Because here's the other part, and this is why I love what you've put together with that polyphenol, high polyphenol olive oil, is don't go to the grocery store and buy that crappy olive oil. Don't just give one big blurb about that, because I still think people are getting duped by that stuff too. Or go to or go out to dinner and ask for olive oil and they'll tell you it's an olive oil blend.
That's right. Yeah. People, early on, we have to kind of train ourselves to get used to the taste of olive oil, because that taste is actually bitter, and that bitter is the polyphenols. And you do have to understand that bitterness, more bitter, more better, the polyphenols take some getting used to. And these blends, there are really very poor rules, standards for olive oil. And olive oil is shipped in tankers. from one country to, for instance, Italy, and it could say bottled in Italy, and you go, oh, great, Italian olive oil is fabulous. But it could have been in a tanker mixed with olive oils from 5-6 different countries, cut with other oils like soybean oil, and there's no commission to test it. There's just not. And there is, it's true, there's an Italian olive oil mafia that's in the business of convincing. You know, 60 Minutes did a huge expose on this a few years ago. And so much of our olive oil is tainted. And it really has been cut to lower the polyphenol content. So you'll say, oh, I'm using olive oil and it's so healthy. And there's basically nothing good in it.
Well, how do you know?
Well, there actually are some quality producers in the United States. Even Costco, quite frankly, has a very good olive oil that's called Toscana. It's Kirkland brand. It comes in a square tall container. I've actually been to the plant in Tuscany where it's bottled. It's certified. There's a little certification on it. Biriani, a great company out of California, phenomenal family. California Olive Ranch does a really good job, but don't get the blends. Get the actual.
Yeah, no blends.
Yeah, stay away from the blends, please. Okay.
And ask your questions at the restaurants.
But,
that's awesome.
You know, if you want the highest polyphenol ever recorded, Gundry MD.
Yeah, I know a guy who's got some.
Yeah, I've got some.
I know. That was like the best present ever to get. Holy smokes. I always like the boxes that I get from you. I'm like, I always know there's something amazing inside. So you'll be able to check all that out. What I'm going to do is I'll put this all at jjvirgin.com/Dr. Gundry, and that is G-U-N-D-R-Y. And I will link to all of your goodies and goodness. You've just produced so much great stuff. And what I love is not only is your information well-researched and actionable, but then you have the tools to be able to go and do it, like the olive oil. So it's really good. And also, for those of you listening, like when we sat down to start this interview, he like took a big gulp of something. I'm like, all right, what was that? I was like, it looked like wine, but I'm like, it's a little early. So I don't think so. So MCT and
MCT
red.
MCT Wellness, Vital Reds.
Yeah,
and
love it.
Yeah, so
you're clearly walking your talk there.
That's just a big giant gulp of polyphenols, and I'm uncoupling my mitochondria even as we speak.
Amen. Well, I uncoupled this morning. I'm clearly going to go uncouple some more. So it's been amazing as usual. I always love having you on the show. You are will be a regular, and I appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks for having me. Good to see you.
You too. All right, obviously we talked about a lot of super cool stuff and very actionable. I'm gonna put everything we talked about at jjvirgin.com/Dr. Stephen Gundry. I will tell you that his polyphenol rich olive oil is amazing. I was like so excited when I got it. I'm like, send more. So you'll definitely wanna check all of that out. And I'll also put the information, you know, I use a sunlight and sauna. Every morning I meditate to Dr. Joe Dispenza in my sunlight and sauna, and then I go outside and get my cold plunge. So I will put information about all three of those things because I was sitting there going, it's like the best lifestyle little mitochondrial uncoupling hit that you can do, just that trifecta. So we'll put info on that as well. And I will see you next time. If you've not yet subscribed, subscribe to jj.com, and I will look forward to the next show with you. Bye.